Welcome to another edition of Sly'sOffice.com, brought to you by the Axley Law Firm and many other great sponsors like the United Steelworkers. Joining us now, John Walsh from the Axley Law Firm. John's a personal injury lawyer. John, if you've been injured in a motorcycle or car accident or due to someone else's negligence, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Yeah, call me at
205-608-257-5666. Okay. So, your thoughts about this decision that came out of the Court of Appeals on medical malpractice.
Medical malpractice, yeah, the Mayo case. Everybody looks at it and thinks it's Mayo, but the plaintiffs pronounce it Mayo, apparently.
Okay.
Now, I have to disclose, I'm on the board of the Patient Compensation Fund. That is the state fund board that's sitting on this nest egg of $1.2 to $3 billion. But I've got some thoughts on this. And essentially, the facts of the case are really disheartening, and you just have to be sympathetic and empathetic. A woman goes in for some problems into the ER, and they basically check her over and tell her to follow up with her personal physician. The next day, she goes to a separate ER, and her septic infection has progressed to the point where she passes out, she's almost comatose, her organs start shutting down, and she develops what they call dry gangrene. And the only alternative at a certain point is to amputate all four of her limbs.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sad, sad case. So it was presented to a jury in Milwaukee as a straightforward medical malpractice case, and the jury made a decision that the doctors had failed to provide Mrs. Mayo with what they call informed consent, meaning before a physician, surgeon, or what have you, actually performs the surgery and such, they should advise you of what the reasonable risks and complications could be. And in this particular case, they really hadn't identified the problem, so they weren't in a position to, they failed to give her an informed consent. So when they released her and she showed up at another ER the next day, the infection was just so far advanced that there weren't any alternatives.
So what did she, did she have sepsis, like a blood infection?
Yeah. And it affected all her organs, of course. And like I say, it's sad as hell. But so the jury ultimately awarded somewhere in the range of $15 million. And of course, Wisconsin has a medical malpractice cap on damages. And the cap for what we call non-economic damages, pain, suffering, humiliation, loss of enjoyment of life. Our cap in Wisconsin is $750,000. And
which is nothing.
Was in front of, what's that?
Well, that's nothing, right? That's
in certain cases, it is absolutely nothing, and this is a very good example. Now, understand this. When the jury starts deliberating, the judge doesn't tell them about the cap. Doesn't say anything about limits at all. And the jury deliberates and comes out with a finding for what will compensate this person for the rest of her life. And so they came in at about $15 million, and I think they gave her husband another million in round numbers. And then people apply the motions. The defense applies the motions, and that is the defense for the doctors, the hospital, and the patient compensation fund. And typically the judge then applies, usually in most cases, reduces the damages to the cap. But in this case, the Milwaukee judge at the trial court level said that, I agree the in this case, given the specific facts of this case, the $750,000 cap is unconstitutional as it applies to Mrs. Mayo, meaning the judge didn't make a determination at the trial court level that the cap was unconstitutional across the board. The judge was saying that under the facts of this case, as applied to this particular family, the cap is unconstitutional.
Well, explain this, because I thought this was settled law in Wisconsin. I thought it had been ruled constitutional. I knew it had been challenged. So how could this happen?
Well, see, it has been challenged, and we started out, I think the original cap going way back to the 1970s was 300, 350. And then at some point, the cap was increased to 1 million. And then some sunset legislation allowed that cap to lapse. So then we had a year or two where there was no cap. And then the legislature came back and decided on a 350 cap, which the Wisconsin Supreme Court, in a decision called the Ferdin case, they decided, the court ruled that the $350,000 cap was really unreasonable and therefore unconstitutional. So they, in essence, declared the $350,000 cap unconstitutional. So then you've got this short period of time where there's no cap again, and the legislature comes back and creates this $750,000 cap. And then a few years ago in the Ferdin decision, the court rules that the 350 is unreasonably low. And typically the reasoning is that when you have a cap like this, the people most hurt and harmed by it are the people with the worst injuries. So the Ferdin court, in a clear majority, written primarily, I think, by Justice Crooks, bless his soul, and I mean that sincerely.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Declared the cap unconstitutional. So then the legislature came and imposed a $750,000 cap, which survived, has survived, until this most recent challenge where, like I say, the trial court said, the problem with this cap is if you use an equal protection analysis, meaning 14th Amendment, equal protection, everybody's afforded the same protections under the law, the $750,000 cap is not an equal protection. In fact, it violates it because it takes the person that's most badly damaged, most badly injured, and punishes them the most.
So what it did
in this case, giving them like 6-7% of their injury.
So what you could deduce would be, this woman was so grievously injured by the decisions of that emergency room that there were people that were getting the same amount she would have been getting, $750,000, that weren't anywhere nearly as damaged as she was. Is that
exactly?
Okay.
I mean, you take a significant injury. Suppose somebody's got $1 million injury in the hypothetical. Typically, a court would apply the $750,000 cap, which means they would recover 75% of their damages. Okay? But on the other hand, in this case, this woman recovers about 5-7% of her damages. So it punishes her the most. And that's the problem. So the fund, the Patient Compensation Fund, and the doctors group filed an appeal. And the plaintiff's attorney also filed an appeal, and the plaintiff's attorney basically made the argument that this is not just unconstitutional as applied to Mrs. Mayo's case, but rather it's unconstitutional on its face because it's such an unreasonable restriction. And the fund filed the appeal on the grounds that the cap is constitutional. And ultimately, a three-judge panel in Milwaukee, led by Chief Judge Kessler, wrote a decision that basically all three agreed the cap was unconstitutional.
All right, this would be Joan Kessler, Kitty Brennan, and Judge Nash,
Brash.
Right? Judge Brash,
Judge Brash.
William Brash,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and. So Kitty Brennan, who was a great trial judge in Milwaukee, Joan Kessler, who was a very good lawyer, and she was at Foley and Lardner for years, those two judges agreed that across the board, meaning on its face, the cap is unconstitutional as applied in every case. The jury should be allowed to set the damages. Judge Brash, on the other hand, agreed it's unconstitutional, but limited his opinion to say, as the trial judge did, it's unconstitutional as applied to these facts. He didn't want to declare it entirely unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. So we've got, a three-judge opinion where they unanimously agree that this is unconstitutional. And, of course, this is certainly going to head to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. The interesting thing is that the Court of Appeals in this case, their decision tracks, as I mentioned, the previous Ferdin case. The Ferdin case is the one that held $350,000 unconstitutional and unreasonable. And so they use the almost identical analysis and came to the conclusion that the $750,000 case, the cap, or the $750,000 cap is, just as they analyzed in Ferdin, is unconstitutional. So that's why this case is now going to go to a Supreme Court that has a slightly different composition than they had at the time. I think it was Chief Justice Abramson wrote the leading opinion in Ferdin.
So is it pretty cut and dry that the state Supreme Court will throw this decision out?
Oh, man. You know, a lot of people immediately conclude that. But, you know, from our years, I'm a bit of an optimist. Probably shouldn't be anymore, but I am.
No, it's good. It's good. It's probably how you survive.
But in the context of this case, if I were a member of the Supreme Court, I'd have no trouble saying it is unconstitutional as applied to this family. I'd be inclined to say it's unconstitutional and it's time for the legislature to revisit it, but I'd have no hesitancy in saying it's unconstitutional as applied to these facts. And, you know, when government acts, they have to act with in such a way as they afford equal protection to people across the board. And if they draw distinctions, they have to be able to justify it. And here, it's awfully difficult to justify someone so catastrophically injured and taken out of life's normal activities. It's hard to justify treating that person the same way you would with somebody with, a million-dollar injury. It just isn't fair, and it isn't equal. So the difficulty is, of course, I don't think this composition of the present Supreme Court necessarily tracks with Justice Abramson.
Although it is interesting, every once in a while this court surprises me. A couple weeks ago I had attorney Marilyn Townsend on, and she won a case before this court in a labor issue regarding unemployment compensation for a worker who'd been fired. The right-wing legislature had come up with these new rules, and she won that case 7-0.
Yeah. No, I'm not saying they aren't ready to surprise us. If they know the political pressure that the tort reform movement generated. But on the other hand, this tort reform movement in medical malpractice, this was created in 1975. And part of the theory was that, medical malpractice insurance premiums for doctors and clinics and hospitals have just gone through the roof, and that we have to control these crazy, wild verdicts people are rendering. And the truth is that I knew, and most people knew, that the limitations under Chapter 655 for bringing medical malpractice cases was really designed to make it much more difficult for injured people to bring a case. And the statistics have borne that out. This malpractice fund we created has accumulated, $1 billion or $1.2 or $1.3 billion. There is no insurance premium crisis. We know that. And really what it's done is it's discouraged many, many lawyers from taking medical malpractice cases because the way they're defended by the doctors, the clinics, and the overriding patient compensation fund. They're so aggressively defended with such a stable of national experts that if plaintiffs aren't winning 1 out of 10, which is insane. Right. And the other side of it is that, or the other component of it is that it's so expensive to take those cases that if you've got a client with a $200,000-$300,000 injury, you can't get a malpractice lawyer to take it. It's too expensive and the risks are too great.
Stand by. We'll talk more with John Walsh from the Axley Law Firm right here at SliceOffice.com.
When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
You're listening to SliceOffice.com, brought to you by the Axley Law Firm, the United Steelworkers, and many other great supporters, including Madison Computer Works. Joining us now, John Walsh. He is a personal injury lawyer with the Axley Law Firm. John, what are the different types of medical malpractice damages that can be awarded? I think people get very confused about this.
They do. Think of it, though, in terms of this, just a normal run-of-the-mill auto accident case. You can recover for your injury. You can recover your medical expenses. And you can recover if you're going to require future treatment. You can recover your future medical expenses. You can also recover lost wages. And of course, if you're killed and you've got dependents, they have a right to recover the contributions your wages would have made to their family, their college fund, their home mortgage payments and such. And then you get to what is called pain and suffering. And, you know, it's the one that people joke about, but in serious cases, it's anything but a joke. What it really is it's the, for so many serious injuries, it's the daily pain, the difficulty in just moving about, doing their job, whatever it is, and the humiliation and the loss of enjoyment of life because you've been substantially limited by your injury. So you can recover those components in typically all cases. The pain and suffering, humiliation and such, those are what we call non-economic damages. Now, if I injure my shoulder or my neck, all right, I've got, and it's going to be permanent, it's not going to go away, all right, I've got that limitation for life. And the jury's allowed to consider my life expectancy and award an appropriate amount for my pain and suffering through all those years ahead. When you get to this medical malpractice case of the Mayos, you've got a woman who has suddenly, in a matter of days, lost all four limbs. And what's the pain, suffering, humiliation that's fair for that person over the rest of their life? And the court concluded that under those circumstances, $750,000 was not only unreasonable, it did not provide equal protection under the law for that victim. So,
and just then, this is a little bit to aside, but when we talk about being insured, not only with an umbrella policy, with being a homeowner, but also having car insurance, sure. What sort of insurance should you have? God forbid you cause an accident, even if it isn't egregious behavior on your part. Every one of us that gets behind the wheel could do damage to someone else. What's the real proper coverage we should have in today's world?
Oh, that's a good question, because very often I have clients who come in and they've been injured in an auto accident, is the easiest example to give. And I find out, and it's very clear the other driver caused the accident, they're completely liable. And I find out that they have only the minimum coverages of $50,000 liability coverage, which is nothing, all right? You can go into the ER in the hospital for a week and eat up $30,000 of that in a heartbeat, okay? So what I always tell my people is this. First, in terms of what we call liability coverage, meaning if you should cause an accident to someone else, at a minimum, I tell people that they want $500,000. Because if you run into a car with one person, you've got plenty of coverage. If you cause an accident and injure three people in the other car, that $500,000 doesn't go that far, all right? Depending on the extent of their injuries, of course. Then you get to what we call the uninsured motorist coverage. It's called UM, uninsured motorist. And it applies when another driver causes you injury and they just don't have insurance. All right. Now, what you want to have there is I personally believe a minimum of $250,000, but I recommend $500,000, in part because this uninsured motorist coverage is designed to protect you, your family, your friends that are in your car, such that, you know, grandma rides with you, you pick up the kids after school, you're driving the soccer kids, whatever it is, you're insuring for that $500,000. You're insuring your friends, family, and passengers against somebody that has no insurance whatsoever. So what you do is you protect those that are close to you. The other thing is this uninsured motorist coverage, the UM that I'm talking about, is really not very expensive compared to what you're covering under the liability portions of your policy. And then you get to the third component that I really recommend, and that's what they call UIM, underinsured motorist coverage, meaning someone causes an accident, your car or your passengers and you are injured, and they only have maybe $50,000 or $100,000 in coverage. Well, that, like I say, if you've got three people in your car that are injured, that $100,000 disappears in a hurry. So you buy what we call underinsured motorist coverage, UIM, and it protects you against those drivers out there that don't buy enough insurance. They've caused you an accident, an injury, and this UIM, underinsured motorist coverage, is also comparatively very inexpensive compared to what you're paid for example, for your liability coverage. And it's, again, it's there to protect, you're buying it to protect your own family, your own friends that are riding with you. So you want to have good liability coverage, but you absolutely want to have uninsured motorist coverage and underinsured motorist.
So you're talking about $500,000?
What's that?
Do you want $500,000 across the board?
I wouldn't consider taking much less. I know it sounds crazy, but when you've done what I've done and people come in the door with serious injuries and you find out the other driver only had $100,000, you know, and you've got $150,000 in medical bills alone, the $500,000 disappears, you know, that gets eaten up pretty quickly.
All right,
the cost of doctoring is just, hospitalization. My client comes in and she was riding in a buggy as an Amish woman and ends up with $140,000 in hospital bills. And the other driver's only got $300,000 in coverage, and three other family members in the Amish family were injured. That $300,000 disappears like that in a heartbeat.
And
sounds crazy, but it's true.
And do you recommend people have umbrella policies as well?
I do. If you've got assets to protect, all right. If you have, you've got pretty good protection in your own home, but if you've got assets you have to protect, I recommend an umbrella policy, and not just an umbrella policy for liability, but when you buy an umbrella policy, you can also add uninsured motorists and underinsured motorists, and the premiums, again, are really not that high. That's what's interesting is some insurance agents, not many more, it's better these days, but for many years, a lot of insurance agents didn't really mention uninsured motorists and underinsured motorists because the premiums were so small that they really didn't make any money on them. All right, I'm not suggesting that there's a conspiracy or anything, but it just wasn't something that was high on their agenda. But on these, the good news is more and more frequently I'm seeing insurance agents who've really taken care of their insured, even though the insured comes into my office and doesn't really understand what they have. But I look at it and I say, the agent's done a good job for you. They bought you uninsured and they bought you underinsured. You didn't pay that much, but they made sure you were protected. And it's nice to see that, especially in this day and age with unpredictable medical bills.
Couple minutes left here. Just you mentioned before we started recording today about a case out of the Seventh Circuit.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The to go back in time, right? Kennedy was assassinated, Lyndon Johnson comes into office, and among the legislation that followed, of course, there was a big push to address discrimination, racial discrimination. So they passed what they call Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Technically, I think it's the Civil Rights Act of about 1870 or something. But in 1964, they passed what they call Title VII. Title VII prohibits discrimination in employment on the basis of race, color, creed, sex, national origin. And basically, it says in employment, you can hire, fire, promote, demote, discipline, do whatever. But you can't do it, make those decisions on the basis of race, color, creed, sex, and national origin. Now, Congress itself has never defined sex to be sexual identification or sexual orientation. Congress has never built that into Title VII. But in the Seventh Circuit, in April, the Seventh Circuit had a decision where they sat en banc, meaning all 11 judges. And in an 8-3 decision, it's called the Ivy decision, 8-3 decision, eight justices said, you can't really define sex without recognizing sexual orientation. So that traditionally people have said race, color, creed, sex, meaning male, female, all right? The court has said, no, it's to be read as race, color, creed, sex, which includes male, female, sexual orientation. And so that's a good and a fascinating decision, because there have been a few other circuit courts around the country that have not ruled that way, basically saying if you're going to change sex to include sexual orientation, Congress should do it. So now we've got what we call a split among the circuits, the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals. And when you have a split among the circuits, that's a pretty good reason for the U.S. Supreme Court to take the case. So this case is it's headed to the Supreme Court.
And by all accounts, I am not hearing encouraging things when it regards the latest associate justice in cases like this.
True. And the other thing is that there has been no stronger advocate, though, for equal rights on the basis of sex, sexual orientation, identity, than Justice Kennedy. Now, he's 81 years old, and the rumors about him retiring this summer apparently have been kiboshed. But, you know, like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you wonder how long they can hang on. But Kennedy has been the key vote on cases involving sexual orientation.
John Walsh from the Axley Law Firm. Give your number one more time for people if they've been injured due to someone else's negligence.
Yeah, 608-257-5661.
All right. John, thanks so much for joining us at Sly's office.
Hey, good talking to you again, Sly.
Sly'sOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers.
Sly'sOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.
Making stuff matters, because when we make things in America, America makes it. American workers and families make it. Our communities make it. Consider this. For every one manufacturing job in our communities, 5 more jobs are supported. Manufacturing jobs pay an average of 10 to 50% more than service sector jobs. That allows working families to support their local businesses, schools, emergency services, and more. Creating 2.5 million new manufacturing jobs would mean at least $100 billion for our economy over the next decade. Domestic manufacturing is the green economy. It's among the cleanest, most efficient, and productive in the world. That's why the United Steelworkers and our more than 1 million members and retirees are fighting so hard to protect and grow manufacturing. Because making stuff really does matter. Join our fight. Visit usw.org and like us at facebook.com/steelworkers. Support American manufacturing. Buy American. Buy Union.